Well, one of the excuses for giving this talk is the fact that it's 200 years since he was born. He was born on May the 30th, 1814. He was born into the aristocracy. His father was one of these, he had 18th century liberal ideas, and he was born on the family estate of Premokino, which is to the northwest of Moscow. Now, Bakunin was a very striking person. You know, he's known, I entitled this speech, The Spirit of Revolt, and for many people he personified the very essence of a revolt. He was a very large man. He was, for that time when people were, on the whole, smaller, he stood 6'5", 5.5 inches tall. And, he was massive as well. Pretty large, imposing guy. So he also had a huge appetite as well. He once, in reply to a questionnaire, what his favourite things, he said, the first thing was to die on the barricades. And the other things, that of his favourite things were drinking, eating. He had vast appetites. When he was having dinner with Richard Wagner, who, believe it or not, considering his later career, was a sort of a revolutionary in 1848, because he took part in the 1848 uprisings. He was amazed by his appetite, the fact that he drank brandy like wine, and regarded wine as a children's drink, and his and huge amounts of food. So he actually decided to model one of the characters in his Ring cycle, that's Wagner, that is, on the Siegfried. He modelled him on Bakunin. Now, Bakunin had, when he was young, he had a very unsuccessful career in the artillery. He hated the military, and all his life he hated authority. He gravitated, he managed to get out of Russia. Remember, Russia is extremely repressive place, run by the Tsarist autocracy, and he was able to study philosophy in Germany, in Dresden, and it was here that his ideas started very slowly becoming radicalised. You've got to remember, Bakunin's life was a constant journey towards more and more radical ideas. Unlike other people, as he got older, he became more radical rather than more conservative, like most people are meant to do. And first of all, he was influenced by the philosopher Fichte, who is very much he personifies a romanticism. But he soon broke with the ideas of Fichte. I think the thing that he picked up most from Fichte was that you've got to give meaning to your life, which he certainly did. And then he was influenced by Hegel. He became a left Hegelian, like many of the younger generation of Germans and some Russians did. Including Marx himself, he understood the idea of materialism that we developed. As Marx said, the left Hegelians turned Hegel on his head. Yeah. He became more and more radicalised. One of the people he met was this German tailor called Wilhelm Weitlin. And now Wilhelm Weitling, he was a journeyman tailor, so he was able to travel across Europe, across France and Germany. And Weitling called himself a communist, and he was one of the founders of the organisation that became known as the Communist League, which Marx and Engels eventually joined. And they wrote the Communist Manifesto for the Communist League. We'll talk about him, about Weitling, a bit more later on. I think the thing that, you know, he was obviously influenced by Weitling, idea of communism, but he had profound doubts about actual Weitling's concept of communism. For him, you know, communism was everything was regimented, everything you did would be regimented, and he had that problem with other people who called themselves communists as well, like the Frenchman Etienne Cabet. But he certainly became far more radicalised. I think the main thing that he got from Weitling, well, one of the main things he got from Weitling, Weitling believed that it was the lowest elements of the working class who would be more likely to make the revolution. And Bakunin took this on board. If you contrast his views to those of Marx, Marx believed that the lower sections of the working class would actually act as hired gunmen for the ruling class when it came to strikes, revolutions. Whereas, you know, both Weitling and Bakunin believed that it was the people who had the least to lose who would be the driving force in a revolution. And, you know, and Marx referred to them as the lumpen proletariat, the ragged or the rogue proletariat, and he wrote them off. You know, whereas Bakunin wanted a broader base for a revolution. There was a whole wave, but by now it's 1848. And there was a whole wave of revolts right through Europe, in France, and right across Germany, etc. And in many ways, you know, 1848 uprisings, they've been compared to something that happened fairly recently, the Arab Springs. You know, a wave of people basically fighting against the autocratic regimes in Austria-Hungary, in France, and in the different states of Germany, because it wasn't united then. He took an active part in uprisings, and he fought on the barricades. Unfortunately, he was apprehended by the state of Saxony after an uprising in Dresden, which he took an important part in, and he spent the next year or so in a Saxon prison. So, but that was nothing compared to what was next in store for him, which was that he was handed over by, it was fairly, for a prison, it was fairly okay, you know, you could have food brought in, etc., etc. And he had 500 cigars brought in, which he smoked in 2 weeks. You know, that's an example of his massive gargantuan appetites. But he was handed over to the Tsar. He refused to go back to, you know, he's supposed to be away for an allotted amount of time in Western Europe, and he hadn't gone back, and you know that was a great crime within the Tsarist autocracy. And he'd taken part in revolutions. You know, his ideas at that time were on the revolutionary wing of of democracy, really. He spent the next period, right up to 1861, in dreadful prisons in Russia. First of all, the Peter and Paul fortress. Then he was transferred from there to the Schlüsselburg fortress, which is it stands on the banks of the River Neva, but the dungeons are below the ground and extremely damp. And he was chained to the wall constantly through this period from late 49 till 18 to quite late on. And the diet was awful. He contracted scurvy, so his teeth fell out, and he suffered from other ailments that affected him over the course of years. He did write a letter of apology to the Tsar. Now, the only reason he wrote that, and he's been castigated for it, the only reason he wrote that was to get out. The Tsar read it and he said, this isn't actually an apology, because, you know, he read between the lines and he wrote on the letter, so do not release this man. Bakunin, he is very fond of being known as the Tsar's most disloyal subject. But he did actually eventually manage to obtain exile in Siberia, which meant he was right over on the other side of the Russian Empire, and he had a certain amount of movement. And he plotted for the next few years to somehow escape. And he did. He managed to catch a Japanese steamer over to Japan. From Japan, he managed to escape across to the United States. He crossed the whole of the United States. And then he got a boat, which landed at Liverpool. From Liverpool, he travelled down to London. And he burst into the house of Alexander Herzen, who was a very well-known... he was a Russian liberal democrat. He had an underground... Well, it was distributed underground in Russia and published in the West, called The Bell. He burst into the house and he saw them having dinner. And he said, "Ah, I see you're having oysters." He began to, you know, he hadn't, despite everything he'd suffered, he hadn't lost any of his revolutionary determination. A lot of the generation of 1848 had fallen away. They'd lost their radical ideas, but he hadn't. If anything, the prison had changed him, and he'd been thinking about ideas of freedom. And he started evolving what could be called anarchist ideas at this time, you know, a society without a state that was run collectively, that was run from the bottom up. And He first of all, he tried to spread his ideas within this group called a liberal group, you know, fighting for rights. He actually argued libertarian socialist ideas within it. It's called the League for Peace and Freedom. So some of the people who were in it were Mazzini and Garibaldi, you know, two of the great fighters for Italian reunification and wresting control away from the Austro-Hungarians who ruled part of Italy. He found out, though, that he made a little progress within this group. He gathered some people around him. He met someone who had very similar ideas in Switzerland called James Guillaume, who became one of his closest associates. But they didn't make much headway, even though he argued very strongly for these ideas that I've just describe. And he decided in 1868 that the group that he was involved in, which was now called the Alliance for Socialist Democracy, nothing to do with social, you know, modern day social democracy, but very much a revolutionary organisation. He decided that the group decided they now go into the First International. Now, the First International was the first major organisation of the working class on an international level. It had come out of wage strikes in France, and as a result of a meeting of French workers who come over for this thing called the International Exhibition in London, where they met with British trade unionists and decided to form an international organisation of the working class itself, which became, you know, a vast organisation. It had sections in Italy, Spain, Holland, Belgium, England, France, etc., and also a section in America, in the United States. Now, this organisation, a lot of people think Marx founded the First International. As I said, he hadn't. But he very soon got on board, and he wrote its statutes and the statement for the First International, the International Working Men's Association. Now, Bakunin had met Marx, at first they got on very well. I mean, Marx said about Bakunin that he was the only person who is still is probably more revolutionary now than he was in 1848, and he was quite impressed by him at first. Before that, I think there's that Bakunin had meetings with this French thinker who came from a peasant background called Pierre-Joseph Proudhon. Now, Proudhon's been described as an anarchist, and he actually called himself an anarchist, but in many ways I don't think he was, not a revolutionary anarchist. But he did have some very interesting ideas that were incorporated into Bakunin's corpus of thought. I mean, the first one was that the working class itself should have organised itself separately, rather than going in have its own independent organisation. So the First International suited him, Bakunin, and not have an alliance, not be in alliance with the liberal elements within the bourgeoisie, which had often happened. It happened in 1848. In fact, Marx had argued for that, in an alliance with the bourgeoisie in 1848. The other ideas he got for him were the ideas of federalism, that instead of a centralised state, that you had a federation of collectives, of communes, that would run society. And that this organisation should be as free and as libertarian as possible. Now, Proudhon himself had some very backward ideas on a lot of others. Issues that, I mean, certainly wasn't a revolutionary. He thought that you could bring about change slowly through a system of setting up mutual banks, mutual societies, and the society he envisaged wasn't a collective or a communist society. It was what you would call mutualism. There would still be a market within it. And workers would gradually gain control of the economy and change society that way. He also had awful ideas on women. He thought that women should stay within the home. And it's something that Bakunin certainly didn't agree with. He came from the Russian tradition, which, you know, within the Russian revolutionary tradition, it had always talked about the equality of women and with men. And if you read Bakunin's statements from that period, you can see how enlightened he was on that question. Proudhon was also an anti-Semite, and that's something that you can find in the letters of Bakunin himself, to his shame, I think. You can offer the excuses that it was very widespread anti-Semitism, but that was one thing that he could be faulted on. But he certainly never systematised any dislike of any anti-Semitism into any programmes at all. To give another example, Marx himself, even though he was a Jew, if you read some of his letters, his and Friedrich Engels' letters, they themselves, there's a huge amount of anti-Semitism in there. You know, he talks about another socialist called Moses Hess as a greasy yid, you know. These ideas are very distasteful ideas, were circulating quite a lot. I've actually seen a copy of Justice, which is the paper of the Social Democratic Federation in this country, which was around in from the 1880s onwards, Marxist group, with some virulent anti-Semitic comments within it. So this is something which, unfortunately, Bakunin can be faulted for. I think, really, he very much influenced him, with federalism, the idea of the independence of the working class. I mean, they talk for hours. There's supposed to be this account of how a friend of the Bakunin's saw them sitting down together in the evening about 6 o'clock to have a chat. He came back the following day about 10 o'clock, they were only just finishing the conversation off. Bakunin was a great debater, so he loved staying up late and talking political ideas. And I think, he was developing his ideas as he met, influenced by Weitling, influenced by Proudhon. I think the fact that he went into the First International was great serendipity, really, because there were workers, especially the French workers, who were actually breaking with the ideas of Proudhon and travelling in further left, if you like, away from Proudhon's gradualist mutualism towards a revolutionary collectivism. So he actually met people who had the same sort of ideas as here within the First International, people like Eugène Varlin, who actually later was executed after the fall of the Paris Commune of 1871, people like Bastelica, Albert Richard, all those people who were workers in southern France. So these people had made a voyage away from gradualist Proudhonism towards revolutionary ideas very similar to those of Bakunin. Now, up to then, Marx had the most influence within the First International, and the First International was was organised in a federal way. I mean, it had to be, really, because it involved different sections spread out across the world. It's the way to operate. So they had an autonomy of action within the International. Marx was opposed to Bakunin entering the First International, and he tried to stop him. And it came to a point that Bakunin said about Marx that he compared him to Proudhon. He always thought that Proudhon was an idealist. He always thought that. But he thought Marx, he valued Marx very, very, very much, you know, for his contribution to the cause of freedom, to socialism. And he actually said, even when he was being slandered over and over again by Marx, he had a very generous nature. He still had some good words to say about Marx, and he said, for example, let's have a look. The Herr Karl Marx, the undisputed leader of the German Socialist Party, a powerful mind backed by deep learning, and a man of whom it may be said without flattery that his whole life has been exclusively dedicated to the greatest cause of the present day, that of the emancipation of labour and the worker. Herr Marx is also beyond question, if not the sole, then one of the principal founders of the International Working Men's Association, blah blah blah. And he admired Marx's work, in particular Das Kapital. And some of Bakunin's supporters, he himself made various efforts to translate Kapital into Russian, and one of his associates, the Italian Carlo Caffiero, did an abridgment of Capital, which was then translated by another close associate of Bakunin, James Guillaume, into French. So, you know, I mean, the people who gathered round Bakunin, you know, they'd all read a lot of Marx's work, and they respected his work on economic analysis. And he himself, you know, one of his associates, I think it was Elie Sayre Clue, said, "Oh, we've read Marx, but you know, a lot of Marx's supporters haven't even opened, turned the page of Das Kapital." So, you know, it wasn't about a difference over economic analysis. Bakunin thought he was that Marx had made a large contribution. Where he did fall out with him was when Marx tried to put forward within the International the idea that the working class should organise itself into political parties and run for parliament, which one of the things that Bakunin was developing was the ideas of anti-parliamentarianism. There was a Rig conference of the International at the London Congress, where a lot of the sections that were supporting Bakunin, you've got to remember that a lot of the sections, particularly the Italian section and the Spanish section, and certainly he had influence within the French section, were very much under the sway of Bakuninist ideas. There was a Rig conference in London in 1871, and Bakunin and Guillaume were both expelled on flimsy grounds, you know, that they'd been involved in some sort of financial misdeeds, which was totally untrue. That was completely untrue. They were expelled for the International. And then Marx moved to centralise the International and increase the powers of its general councils. And further to that, he actually took away the General Council from where its seat in London over to New York, was far away from where most of the sections were. Now, this met with horror within the sections, and it wasn't just people, you know, who had anarchist ideas. within the international who were horrified by this. It was the very, you know, sort of rather dull and plodding English trade unionist section as well who were horrified. The Belgians as well, who only shared some of Bakunin's idea. And so they formed a different wing of the refused to accept the decisions of the London Congress, and they set up their own version of the International called the Anti-Authoritarian International. You've got to remember that there'd been slander about Bakunin before that. It had been spread by people associated with Marx as well. They said that he was a Russian spy, you know, when he first reappeared in Europe. Russian spy, an embezzler, all sorts of things like that. But Bakunin himself, you know, by now, you know, his lifestyle and the depredations that he faced within prison, you know, had a severe effect on his health. And he actually resigned from the from political activity. And he died a couple of years later in Switzerland in 1876. Before then, with his wish to die on the barricades, you know, he thought, I'd go out of the bank. He took part in an uprising in Bologna, which was a failure, and he, to his great shame, had to make his escape disguised as a priest. That this is another thing about Bakunin, and he developed the ideas of a militant atheism. He believed, and he wrote some pieces on it, including one called God and the State. He believed that if you look towards a supreme being, that was, you know, a hierarchical outlook, which was replicated. If you worshipped some sort of god, supreme being, then you're more likely to be subservient to powers on the earth itself. And he was very outspoken about that. You know, he said that if you wanted to bring one of the key things was that you should be a militant atheist. The other before he died, I mean, he made a contribution to analysis of the Paris Commune. The Paris Commune was probably one of the first great workers' uprisings in 1871, and it was crushed with incredible ferocity by the French authorities. It came at the end of the Franco-Prussian War. Now, both Marx and Bakunin wrote pamphlets about that, and in very many ways they're similar. They should be read side by side, really. And I think, you know, Marx himself adapted to the times. I think he saw that, you know, the commune could be the basis of a future society, and certainly Bakunin advanced that within his ideas. It was an extra item. Bakunin died in 1876 and is buried in Bern in Switzerland. Well, what are the other elements of his thought that I've left out? I think one of the other things he talked about was that he believed that you had to win over the peasantry. I mean, he was sanguine about the peasantry. He knew there were problems with it, you know, the idea of owning your own land. But he thought a revolutionary programme could win over the peasants to the side of the working class. You've got to remember then, the peasantry was much larger class than it is now. And it's shrunk a lot with the development of modern capitalism. Unlike a lot of Marxists, although to his credit, Marx himself developed ideas about peasantry, he started to examine examining the Mur, which is the peasant commune, and he thought it could be a factor with, for revolutionary change. He actually thought that. But people like Kautsky and Luxembourg totally discounted the peasantry, and so they weren't, they could not be revolutionary. They could not be. And they were a reactionary class. And this carried on, you know, Lenin himself was, you know, he talked about forming an alliance between the workers and the peasants, but only in the short term. And Trotsky was even more, who came from a rich peasant background, actually he was from a Kulak, rich peasant background, was very, very virulent against the peasantry. So that's another item. You know, he believed in a very broad-based revolution that drew in the peasantry, that drew in the lower sections of the working class. I think, you know, he had this constant energy. He was developing his ideas right throughout his life. He stopped calling himself a communist because he associated communism with the authoritarian ideas of Cabet and Weitling, even though he'd been influenced by them, and he called himself a collectivist. He hadn't actually developed, and if he'd lived, I get the feeling that he would have moved in that direction, like most of the people around him did, towards anarchist communism. He believed in something called anarchist collectivism, where you were rewarded if you contributed to this new society, if you made a contribution to it. Whereas, you know, anarchist communists developed the idea from each according to means to each according to, rather the other way around, to each according to their abilities. So, you know, you would share, they would have a communism straight away. With a common treasury where people could take what they, you know, food and other items out from the common storehouse. And certainly all of his closest associates, the ones who survived, say, 1871, etc., moved in the direction of anarchist communism. But he was unable to make that move. I think, you know, from what if you read his later writings, I think he was moving in that direction. Certainly, what his very closest associate, James Guillaume, did move there. Okay, now Bakunin himself, he's been portrayed as a, you know, you read some of the biographies of him, and there's one by E.H. Carr, which makes him out to be some sort of clown, basically. And for ages, that was the only biography there was. This one's come out quite recently, and it's just a far better, by Mark Layer, it's a far better portrayal of his life in this particular biography. You can actually get this rebounded, usually for about a fiver. It's worth reading, and there's two other books that have actually given credit to his actual ideas. Now there's a book by a guy called Saltman, and then there's another one that came out more recently by a guy called Paul McLaughlin, who Bakunin, philosophical basis for his ideas. He's been because Leninism has been the main current within the broad socialist movement for many years. I mean, that's what, and that's one of the reasons why he's been portrayed as a charlatan, someone who believed in who had these fantasies about groups, you know, that were only in his own imagination. And in actual fact, he'd actually developed a huge network right across Europe, right into Eastern Europe, of people who shared his ideas. He was an amazing letter writer. And used to sit down every day and write letters to people trying to influence them. And he did build up some sort of loose network. So, you know, it's not a fantasy that there was this sort of international fraternity of revolutionaries. Often they had to write in invisible ink. It sounds like something out of Secret Squirrel, doesn't it? Or in code. So there's an example of one of the postcards that the Bakuninists wrote. That's in code. You can sort of see it. So it's because they, you know, a lot of places they were, of course, people they were corresponding with were in very repressed, in very repressive societies. The other thing that's been levelled at him was that he was a sponger. And yes, he was. He didn't work. He never worked. And he sponged off rich people. You know, he got loans from them, which he never repaid. But you could say the same thing about Marx. Where did Marx get his money from? He got it from, he didn't work. Hardly wrote a few journalistic articles. But he got all of his money from Fred Engels. So, calling someone was, it's a bit of double standards, really. Yes. So, I say that, you know, his contribution to libertarian, socialist, anarchist ideas was amazing. He actually formulated the basis, really, he and the people he was he'd come into contact with formulated the basis of modern anarchism, you know, related to the working class. He certainly was, you know, there's another thing he's been described as a terrorist. He was never engaged in that sort of thing. He always believed that you had to depend on, and more and more as he got older, depended on the mass organisation of the working class. He described this in detail. He talked about general strikes, but he realised, you know, beyond a general strike, you had to have an insurrection as well to destroy the state. And he developed the ideas of non-hierarchical horizontal society. And just before he died, he said, "I will die and the worms will eat me, but I want our ideas to survive so that we have a society without leaders and without heroes." And I think you can see the result of his work today, you know, over the last 100, longer now, here with the emergence of the anarchist movement, and if you like, re-emergence of the anarchist movement after the Second World War. Okay, I'm going to leave it there. We've only got I've talked for quite a long time. For questions, if you like, I'm going to sit down now. So, any questions?
Kuhn, like, was on board with Marx's economic analysis in Das Kapital.
Yes.
Does that sort of indicate that he was sort of okay with historical materialism and that kind of approach to sort of history?
What, you mean historical and dialectical materialism?
Yeah.
Well, he always called himself a materialist. I'm not sure he actually was that big a fan of dialectical materialism, you know, thesis, antithesis, and synthesis. And he never really actually talked about it in his writings. But in a lot of ways, you know, he was a materialist, so he analysed society as it was, and, you know, from an economic and political point of view. So he was very much a materialist in that way. And that's one of the reasons that, and he, as I said, he criticised Proudhon for being an idealist. Anyone else? Have I answered all your questions?
I've got a number one.
All right then.
So when Marx like sort of dismisses the peasantry as like central revolutionary class.
Yes. Well, like I said, I don't think he completely dismissed the. I would say it was followers of Marx,
yeah.
Like Kautsky. I mean, basically, the antipathy towards the peasantry really sort of emerged with Kautsky. And certainly, it was carried on, it was passed on to people like Jobbikers and Rosa Luxemburg within the German Polish movement, and also to the Bolsheviks. You know. They were very antipathetic towards the peasantry as a class.
I think it was like mainly because of the sort of association of peasantry with sort of a feudal form of society.
It's to do with the fact that they thought that the main that they were, if you like, well, they had very often a lot of them. Most peasants had very small parcels of land. They wanted land, so they became owners of land, or if you like, of property, and therefore they couldn't develop revolutionary ideas because of that. But, you know, if you look at some of the peasant uprisings that took place, particularly in Russia, that's not the case at all. You know, they did want collectivisation. And certainly with the Maccabees movement in the Ukraine, they wanted the collectivisation of the land, not it, for it to be broken up into parcels of, you know, with a peasant owning a little plot or a big plot of land. They were actually wanting collectivisation.
Were the Maccabees followers of the country?
Well, they were anarchist communists. Yeah, they were certainly influenced by Bakunin, but they were influenced by Kropotkin as well. Yeah.